experiences in D.C. and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is How Does Your Community Remember? We have a very qualified panel, but first, please welcome Jennifer Pierce, a reporter of the Salt Lake Tribune.
Pleasure to be with you this afternoon. Again, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and will be your moderator. And again, we're discussing remembering. The theme that you've seen all over campus this week is You Remembers. And this week we've focused on the particular catastrophe of World War II, but sadly that's hardly the only incidents of tragic national loss. So today we're going to broaden that discussion a bit with our distinguished guest. Irene Ota is diversity coordinator for the College of Social Work at the University of Utah, and she's in the center. Also with us, businessman and former U.S. Ambassador John Price on the far end, as well as Professor Armando Salarzano, professor of Family and Consumer Studies and Ethnic Studies here at the University of Utah. Just a note about format, each of them will take 5-10 minutes to talk about what this topic means to them, this collective sorrow theme, and then I'll ask a few questions to get you thinking, and then you are invited to join our discussion, so get those questions ready. Let's start with you, Ambassador Price. Can you talk a bit about your story, who you are, where you come from, and the specific circumstances that have brought collective sorrow to your community?
Okay. Well, let me start with a famous statement by President Kennedy when he went to Berlin. He said, "Ich bin ein Berliner." Well, I'm a true Berliner from Germany, and I was born in Spandau. My real name is Hans, and my last name is Pleiser. So it spells out when you come over to the United States through immigration authorities, through Ellis Island, to move everyone through, our names were anglicized and it became John Price. I emigrated, rather escaped, with my father, mother, and my brother in 1939, in April the 8th. It was a few months after Kristallnacht. Kristallnacht was a night of broken glass when thousands of Jewish synagogues were broken into, Torahs burned, many businesses destroyed, among them my father's. And it was really the beginning of the end for most Jews who had waited too long to leave. Nobody wanted to leave any more than you would leave your home. It's your homeland, your belongings are there, your family. But you get to a point where my father decided he had to leave everything behind. And he had a number of businesses and real estate and what have you. And so we were lucky enough to have an attorney that was an Aryan, wasn't Jewish. So he was able to work with the police and using my father's limited resources, we were able to get passports to Panama. Two of them under the Polish quota and two under the German quota, because my father was German, my mother was Polish originally. So we escaped on a ship that was going back to Panama. It was the last ship to leave Bremerhaven, which was a harbor there in Bremen. And it was going to Panama. Now, the ironic thing about that is when I go visit the Holocaust Museum, they have these passports and visas all over on a map from people from all over the world that escaped. Not one of them was up there from Panama. But if you want to see the original one, just go up to the Jewish Community Center downstairs in the garden that we built. And in the archives there, you'll see copies of the passports and copies of the visas to Panama. So that's where we went in the bottom of a ship on April the 8th, 1939. But there was a provision that we had to leave Panama within 18 months, or they'd deport us back to Germany, which is the same thing that happened to a lot of ships that came over with Jews. One of them, famous, I can't think of the name of the ship, went to Cuba, and the Cubans wouldn't let them off. And only two people qualified for a Cuban passport, so the rest was shipped back, and the U.S. wouldn't take them. The United States turned their back on 1,200 people that went back to Europe, and that was the end of those folks. So we were, we didn't know about that, of course, but we were concerned that if we had to leave, we'd be going back to Germany. So luckily, in those days, you had to have a sponsor. And a sponsor was responsible for bringing you in. Today, immigrants can come in, just walk in, and there's enough government programs that will take care of immigrants until they get established. But that wasn't the case. There was no programs. Nothing existed. So a distant uncle became our sponsor. And that's a difficult task, ask someone to take the responsibility for finding work for us and food for us and so on. But it happened, and we came in, luckily, within a few months of losing that opportunity under the same visas to the U.S. in 1940. So that is where our great American dream began. And as most immigrants that came in at that time, we all loved our country. We all loved the language. We all learned the language. We became educated in the language of commerce. And it was a great time for immigrants because that group of immigrants that came over that were lucky to get in the 40s, all I met many of them. I went to school with them in New York. That's where I was raised, New York. And they all contributed to society, and they all had remembrance, and they continue to this day. It seems like the newer generations don't either want to remember or there's not enough emphasis put on it. And we need to work on that because it isn't just the Holocaust in Europe where 6 million Jews were killed. You also had gypsies that were killed. You had other religions that were killed. You had people that were physically handicapped, people that just didn't fit into what the Aryan society wanted people to be, that were also killed. So it wasn't just Jews that were killed. And that, of course, has gone on through history, even in recent years, where I look around the room, and some of you will remember Rwanda in 1994. And, of course, there are many before that, but in our recent years, Rwanda. And we can go on into our current history where there's wars going on almost in every Middle East country, and there's annihilation of people going on every day. So it's genocide that we have to focus on, and also remember the history that brought some of that about, the great one, which was the Holocaust.
Thank you, Ambassador. Irene Ota, share your story with us.
Well, okay. I'll share what the Japanese and Japanese Americans remember, and their historical trauma, or their Holocaust, or their cultural attempt at cultural genocide. I was born in Japan, and we immigrated over after the war. So my parents don't have an internment story, but my parents have the firebombing story, right, in Japan. We lived in Japantown. Anybody know where that is?
It's over by the Salt Palace.
Okay, well, it was over there by the Salt Palace.
The
it was
of
the Salt
Japantown.
Palace, right? It doesn't really exist anymore. The two churches still exist, but Japantown, as it was, as I remember it, doesn't exist any longer. And Japantown existed because of discrimination, because of segregation, but once you have an ethnic enclave, right, it becomes a magnet too. And that's why my parents went there, because that was a place where they could speak their language, right? They didn't know English. That's where they could speak Japanese. That's where they could be with other Japanese and Japanese Americans. That's where they could buy. My mother hated American food. That's where she could buy the food she was familiar with, that she liked. All of that's gone now. Does anybody know why it's gone? Something called urban development and urban renewal. So the place that we were was not a very desirable place. It was right by the railroad tracks when they were working railroad tracks, right? And so when it's still a working railroad, it's not a very safe or clean place to be. That's where the gateway is now, right? If you can imagine what that looked like before. So Japantown's gone now, but when we talk about Japanese Americans and their history, Japanese and Japanese American history here in the United States, we typically talk about pre-war, war, and post-war. And that's typically what we talk about when we talk about our day of remembrance. So when they came here, they were recruited, right? We were recruited to work on the railroad. There was never any expectation that they would stay, that as soon as the job was over, they'd go back. And there was xenophobia, just like the Chinese Exclusionary Act. This is why the Japanese had to come, because America got very afraid that there were too many Chinese here, and so we wanted to stop that immigration, and we created the Chinese Exclusionary Act, which said no more Chinese. But we still needed exploitable, cheap labor, and we reached out to the Japanese. And why did the Japanese come? It's because it's like Mr. Price said, they don't come because they hate their country, that they don't like it there. Why did they come? Anybody know why they came? This is me, this teacher and me, I'm always saying, no, let's have a dialogue. You need to talk to me. Because they just had a war with Russia, which they won, but it was a very devastating war, right? And the government was very unstable at that time. And so people were coming. They were coming because of economic issues. They don't come because they hate their country, because they don't like it there. They come because for different reasons. So that's why the Japanese came. And then after they were here, we finished the railroad. We got afraid again, and we said, "Well, you know what? I think there's way too many Japanese here." And so they passed the Gentlemen's Agreement Act, which said, you know, it sounds a nice name, right? Gentlemen's Agreement Act. Yeah. No, it was the Chinese Exclusionary Act, except it said no more laborers, right? No more Japanese laborers. And so we were restricting that immigration as well. The Japanese are here. They had picture brides. They started families. They were getting settled here. And then something else happened. And that's our day of that's not our day of remembrance, but that's the beginning. That's the beginning of the middle period, the war, and its impact on Japanese and Japanese Americans. Does anybody know the day that will live in infamy, right? You know that? You've heard that? If not, then you need to bone up on your history. Right? The bombing of Pearl Harbor. Okay? And there's a lot of controversy around that, about how it was a sneak attack, nobody knew, those horrible Japanese, blah, 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 blah. If you really look at the history, it's because Roosevelt wanted to get into the war. He was putting sanctions and pushing, aggravating the Japanese government. They responded by the attack on Pearl Harbor. The documentation shows that Roosevelt knew it was coming. Okay, so the attack on Pearl Harbor, and everybody knows where Pearl Harbor is? Where's
Hawaii?
Hawaii, okay. How close is Hawaii to the West Coast? California, Washington, Oregon? And think of 1940s. How quickly? When? Huh? Okay, it's kind of far, right? And how far is Hawaii from Japan? Kind of far. And how far then West Coast to Japan? Kind of far, right? And think of the 1940s, of how far the distance in our technology. Okay, so in response, in February 19th, and that's what we call our day of remembrance, was Presidential Executive Order 9066. Anybody know what that is? The Japanese internment. Isn't that a nice word? Right? Internment camps, internment, internees, instead of prison camps or concentration camps and prisoners of war, right? Which is what they were. And two-thirds of those that were interned, 120,000 off the West Coast, California, Washington, and Oregon, were actually American citizens. They were the second generation born here. Two-thirds, right? So all their constitutional rights removed into 10 different concentration camps located in the middle of godforsaken nowhere, right? Mostly in the deserts. There were two in Arkansas. Can you imagine? In the swamplands of Arkansas. So, and so all the constitutional rights taken, all your economic stabilities, your homes, your businesses, you could only take what you could carry. So imagine, I'm going to ask you, you've got the internment order. You've got 4 days to take care of everything, and you can only pack what you can carry. And you've got 2 kids, 5 and 6, right? And you don't know where you're going, and you don't know for how long what you're going to pack. That's a dilemma, right? And so we typically refer to our day of remembrance as Executive Order 9066. And if we talk more and whatever, this cultural genocide or this historical trauma gets even more exasperated, reinforced and perpetuated by what's now called the model minority stereotype. And I can go into further what that looks like and how that perpetuates this Holocaust or this genocide in ways that you might not expect it to.
Thank you, Irene. Professor Solorzano.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I have been in this forum many, many times, but I never heard talking about our experiences. So I really appreciate the committee that put this together and allow us to share our experience. I think I'm a very different product of humanity, if you want to look at it in terms of racial composition. My mother is French. My mother is... my father is a native Mexican, an Indian. My wife is Italian, and don't ask me about my children. And I said that because, again, for us, the Day of Remembrance is every hour of our lives. And before I share with you some images, I want to preface my presentation with 3 points. First of all, as an ethnic group, which, and I've been pushed as a Mexican-American, Latino, Hispanic, we do have our mythologies. We do have our vision of history. We do have our mission. But what happened historically is that these mythologies, this vision, this accomplishment has been destroyed 3 times. So our memories of sorrows is carried with a very intensive feeling that our purpose in history is to maintain our identity as Mexican Americans, as Latinos. A people without identity is not a people. A group, an ethnic group without vision will perish. And is this sharing of mythologies as any other group? We are not together just because of the fact that we speak Spanish and we are Catholics. That is a myth. It's the wrong myth. We are together as a people because we have a historical mission to fulfill. The challenge for us is that we have experienced people's Holocaust. We have experienced what is called the cultural Holocaust, the elimination of a culture, and we face what is called cultural genocide. And the challenge for us is to keep the memory of the people, of all people, alive. Again, because that is going to be our contribution to the United States. Again, as any other group, we are told that our experience of oppression, submission, and exploitation is not comparable to other groups. But as Latinos, as Mexican Americans, we know that it doesn't matter what kind of oppression or submission, that is a hindrance to the development of the human potentials. So for a Latino, the oppression of one single human being is enough to raise our voice and claim the dignity of our race. And in our historical memory, as Latinos, we have the responsibility to write and bring these memories alive. Because by doing that, we are inserting our experience in the history of all humanity. And that, as a preface, I want to share with you some images that it will help you to understand why the Day of Remembrance for us is every single day of our life. Remembrance for us is a matter of die and death. If we show the first image, this is exactly how our vision starts as a son of a native and Indian people in our continent. Before the coming of the Europeans, we have our language, we have our projects, we have a civilization. A civilization so powerful that it was the only civilization in the world that created the zero. That's why when they called me to parent teacher conference and the teacher said, "Oh, your son is very smart in mathematics," I said, "What's new here?" He is a descendant of the Aztecs. After all, we invented the mathematics. What you are trying to tell me? Okay. What I'm trying to project? this historical project of the native people of the continent with our language, that is not an accidental part of who we are, is an essential to our being. Why? Because our language is related to the land. Without the land, there is no culture. Without culture, there is no language. And that's why we are going to be defending our language in this country. Not because it's better, not because it's worse, but because it's a form of human expression. It's a way of recognizing each other based on our projects in life. I'm very interested in our situation in Utah as Latinos, because when I came to Utah 25 years ago, I suffered what is called cognitive dissonance. As a child, at the age of 3, I learned that Utah was part of Mexico. When I came here, nobody knew about that. Nobody recognized it. So my reality, my internal reality as a human being, did not coincide with my environment. So I knew that this goddess or goddesses, based on our mythologies, that you can find in Sego Canyon near Tucson, Utah, was the foundation of the Aztec calendar. This has been destroyed, as the Aztec calendar was also destroyed when the Europeans came to our continent, based on another myth, the myths of manifest destiny. But we do have our myths at that particular time. The second time when our history was destroyed is that after Dominguez y Escalante came to Utah, all the names were given in Spanish, because that has a symbolism to us. When, with the arrival of the pioneers in 1847, they changed all the names. It took me about 15 years tracking the two groups. So what happened when the names are changed? You don't find a sense of identity with the land. Another cognitive dissonance in our population. It's not the same to go to the city of Los Angeles than to go to Manti, than to go to Lehigh. Our history was interrupted one more time. Cultural genocide. This situation play in the mind of our people, because again, we are part of the history, and sometimes we believe what other people say. This is a very good exercise. The first one of the writers in 1940, when the first, remember, beginning of World War II, right? Well, people start coming, and what do they find? This is a very good expression. They ask to the people who the first time come to Utah, to Latinos, where are you going? To Utah. Where is Utah? I don't know. I think it's in Japan. We lost the sense of destiny. We understood that Utah was no part of our heritage. Our memory was lost. Our memory was erased. I'm going to jump very fast again because there is no time. And I wish we will be invited again to share this sense of Holocaust for our communities. Because again, we want to be listened. This situation happened in 1996. You can characterize it whatever you want. It's the new massive immigrations of Latinos to the state of Utah. Who comes with them? An illegal virgin, the Virgin of Guadalupe, who appears on the trees. And for us, this is not popular religion. Divinity is in nature. Nature reflects its own characteristics. The image of the Virgin of Guadalupe in 200 is and 700 South. You have seen that. It's not a commercial, but just across from the Japanese restaurant.
Coco Kitchen.
Coco Kitchen. Okay. 1996, you can see, well, the image in the picture is very clear, the image at the center. Okay. We regain a sense of territory. We sign against of land, a sense of identity. 1998, in the middle of the night, with a chisel, a group, a religious group, went and destroyed the holy image. Third intervention in history. What do we do, brothers and sisters? Peace on earth. You can destroy your culture, but you cannot destroy your dignity. We were here 15,000 years ago. We are here now, and we will be here until the end of the continent. To our surprises, Mexican-American Chicano artist who live in France heard about the tragedy. Of course, for the government of Utah, it was not a tragedy. They want to cut the tree. They want to cut the tree. We want to build a basilica. How we are going to communicate? Locally, this artist came and create the issue of Madonna that is in the tall building, if you can see, on 200 South and 300 East. Have you seen that? Yeah. Oh. And you will see a bunch of Mexicans in their cars praying from the car to a virgin who is up there. For us, it's regaining the territory. Again, we are not into ownership. We are into markers, into places, into land. This is not the Virgin of Guadalupe, but it's the image of a very young virgin who are the undocumented people. If you look at closer, the heart of this virgin is not really a heart, it's the matrix. It's the place where the children are born, because we are continuously born in this city, in this state, in this country, in this nation. The counterattack came to us because for the first time, the image of a deity, a female deity, was placed in downtown. Mainstream culture understood that we were defying the male figures of the god. That is not the purpose. This virgin is always looking at the east, where the sun comes, where light is important to us. It defies what is in downtown, and is there these days for us to see. Also, as a daily practice of our memory, with the help of a lot of officials, we create the Cesar Chavez Boulevard. It's impossible to create or to rename a state street Cesar Chavez. And we fought for 3 years, and they only gave us from 600 to 1,000 East. They only gave us 4 blocks.
We got one block.
We're happy. But for us, again, it's an attempt, right, to identify ourselves. It's a way to tell you we belong. It's a way to tell you the great spirit, the spirit of the Indians, told us that nobody owns the land. It was only lended to us. We are here to take care of that. We are here to remind us. So this, again, is one of the greatest accomplishments that we have done in the state of Utah in this sense of regaining identity. For me, the biggest problem in this cultural holocaust is presented in terms of religious political vision. In Utah, we believe that there is only one mythology, and that is Zion, the city of God on earth. But before the pioneers came, we have our mythology, right? This is Aztlan. This is the sacred land of the native people. What are we going to do with two mythologies? Are they conflicted? We claim they are not, because they come for very deep, intimate human expression of freedom and creativity. And we respect that. And our new immigrants are telling that. We don't call immigration, as the majority, as the Anglo-American imagination call us, you are immigrants. We are not immigrants. We are returning to our sacred land, the land that we left 1,000 years ago. And we learned this from the Jewish tradition. There is an Exodus, there is a Genesis, there is an exile. But we always come back. We are not immigrating to North America. We are returning to our sacred lands. And I don't want, I know, you give me the whole hour, but I don't want to be abusive, because I want to hear all the forms of sorrow, different types of memories, different ways of preserving what makes us human. And above all, I want, again, share with all these wonderful people in this room the sense that a better humanity can be achieved, that we can arrive to better level of consciousness. We want to go beyond the hierarchy of victims. Right. The problem for us, and I think I shared this with Irene and probably with Ambassador, the challenge for us is how to make you to remember something that you would rather forget. Thank you much.
Thank you. I'll ask a couple of questions, but start thinking about questions that you have. Professor, you talked about a responsibility to remember. Who is responsible? Is it does it differ from culture to culture? Is it mother to child? Is it over the pulpit? Who in your community is responsible to remember?
You know, as Latinos, as Mexican Americans, we do belong to the cosmic race. Okay, we are the product of the mestizo, the mixture of Indians and Anglo-Europeans, and we share the experience of the African people who ended up in the south of Mexico running from the Underground Railroad. We have all the races in us. So from my perspective, from our perspective, the responsibility is everybody's. In my body, I carry the contradictions. I am the victim, but I am the colonizer. And that contradiction brings me to believe that it's everybody's responsibility, because it's our history. It is not my history. It's your history. If you believe that you are part of this human essence, this human presence. Yes, practically, is the responsibility of the older generations. Is the responsibility of us, the professionals, the teachers. Because people, Latino people, are entangled right now in the material survival. For me, material survival is not an issue. I fight for my spiritual survival in this country. So I have the responsibility to tell my people, remember your vision? Remember that you are not immigrant? Even if you go back to Mexico, you are going to be an immigrant there too. Because we are called to a higher sense of destiny. It's the responsibility of the bishops. And I'm not talking about Catholic bishops. I'm talking about LDS bishops. I'm talking about ministers that see the spirituality in all of us. I see the responsibility in elementary school. I think this presence of us here will be unnecessary if you will have learned or memory of sorrow when you were in elementary school.
Mm. Irene, John Price, thoughts?
Well, I agree that it is our responsibility as a society, and when you look at what's being taught in history, is what's taught in as American history, U.S. history, or even Utah history, that we often get left out of that history, of that knowing, right? And it is, it's American history. What happened to the Japanese Americans, the Japanese and Japanese Americans here in the United States of America, is American history. It's not Japanese history. It's not Japanese American history. It's an American history. It did happen to the Japanese and Japanese Americans, but it happened to us here. So, yeah, I would like to see the way we teach history, where the way we teach knowledge change that is more inclusive. It can't be the Eurocentric, ethnocentric, Eurocentric way of glamorizing, mythicizing, and only focusing on European accomplishments and what they gave to America, right? A lot of other peoples, populations gave to America, and they gave through their own bodies, their hearts, minds, and souls. But as far as who's doing it, right, it is the Japanese American community. It's the Japanese American Citizens League. That's who's doing it, I guess, because they have a personal investment. I'm not, you know, to keep people to remember, because as the saying goes, for those who forget history, right, are doomed to repeat history. And so we need to understand what we've done so we don't do it again. When 9/11 happened, the talk was we should intern Muslim Americans. We should do that. And it was the Japanese American Citizens League, and Japanese Americans that said, no, wait a minute, remember what you did at World War II, right? So that this remembering is important. And it's not just about sorrow, it's about resiliency, right? But then again, society takes that and skews it, and I'm going to bring it back to the model minority stereotype and how it's skewed and used as a way to create divisiveness and again, mythicizing and as a form of cultural genocide, I believe.
Mm. John Price?
Well, I have a broader view. I don't see the world as being very narrow. I see it becoming very small. There are 192 different countries. Actually, it's 193 with South Sudan. And every one of those countries, through immigration and refugees and asylum seekers, are in the United States. The United States can go back like any other country and go back thousands of years and who claims the land and who was here first and so on. And that's a problem in the entire world. You see it going on in the Ukraine today. You're going to see it going on continually, everybody claiming that it's part of their turf. I look at it as a universal issue in the United States. We are the United States. Right or wrong, that's what we are. And we have certain establishments in the Constitution, rights that are established, ways of commerce, and trying to create equality. Now, equality is very difficult. We may be all born equal, and I believe that, but we're not going to end up equal. There's nothing we can do about that. And we can't decide we're going to take from another and redistribute, because at that point we have a breakdown of the entire country and the economic system that made this country so great. Why do people come here, want to come here? Because freedom, the opportunity to expand. Now, in our family, we kept our culture, but we kept it at home. We practice our religion, and in New York, where we lived, there are thousands and thousands of immigrants from different walks of life, and they're very happy to be in the country. So I look at the country as the United States has to be the first and foremost that we have an allegiance to. We can have allegiances to our own culture, and we can have allegiances to our own great-grandfathers and go back further in genealogy, but I think if we start to divide the country, we will fail. And I'm a strong believer of that we are starting to fail, because we have so many divisible factions, and I think everyone has their right, but within the limits of not taking their rights above somebody else's. And so I look at it that the country was started 240 years ago. Let's move forward in the country. Now, we shouldn't forget genocides. We shouldn't forget all the inequities that have taken place. But they can't be something that we can say one has a bit more right than another. And I get very distraught when I don't see the American flag flying everywhere at every school. When I start seeing participating flags, it bothers me. It bothers me. Accommodations bother me. So, and I'm an immigrant, but I'm an American first now. I can't think of it any other way. And I would die for this country. And even though I have relatives in Europe, I helped them all out. My brother lives in Vienna. My brother was with the Atomic Energy Commission. He gets by there, but not very much, because he didn't make a lot of money, so I help him. I help other relatives. And that's my goal. But I don't think that we should divide America and go back thousands of years. That's my belief. Yet, in remembering, I think it's a community thing. I think every family needs to respect each other. I think we need to respect our neighbor. We should not forget any genocide that's taken place in the world. And we should do what we can to help people that are disadvantaged. But beyond a lot of those aspects, we are one nation, indivisible under God. And when we forget that, then we become a very broken up nation. And I'm not talking about a military nation, because we're making mistakes there in turning our country from diplomacy by individuals to diplomacy by military. And that's one thing I don't agree with. And we have to get back to diplomacy, where we talk to people we don't like. We need to negotiate with people we don't like. There are world leaders that we don't agree with. Negotiate, negotiate, negotiate. That's what we got to do.
Forgive me, we only have a few more minutes. So
I wanted to clarify my viewpoint of how I see where we are today in a modern society.
Thank you so much. Questions from the audience. If you would come up and use the microphone and identify yourself. We are recording for radio.
And we just ask you to state your full name.
Hi, my name is Brianna Kirkbride. I'm a political science and history major. And when I was in high school, we were talking about Japanese internment camp in one of my AP classes. And I went to school in Utah, only a couple miles from a Japanese internment camp. And only a handful of people knew about it. Do you believe that the United States, in the way that we teach history, is heroicized in never doing anything wrong? Because it seems that, especially when we look at World War II, we put a lot of focus on this is what Nazi Germany did. This is how horrible it was. The Russians did the same thing, only they were our allies. But we never talk about Japanese internment. We never talk about the breakdown of culture. Do you believe that that's how mainstream history is going, or do you believe that that's just people not wanting to remember?
I think it's not wanting to remember, but again, remember that there are winners and losers, right? And there are colonizers who are the winners, and there are people with power who are the winners, and it's the winners who get to write history, okay? And history is written to glorify the winner and disparage or make invisible the losers, okay? And you're not going to present a picture of you that's damaging. And this is part of why we write history. If you went to any other country, their history would be written the same way, right? In Japan, they don't even know about the internment camps. It's not part of their history. They don't write about it. If someone's educated in Japan and comes here, they're like, the internment camps, what? They don't know anything about it, okay? But remember who gets to write history. Right. And it's, again, it's a very Eurocentric view, right? It's a very ethnocentric view, which means a superior view. And so you're right. We don't want to say where we've made mistakes. We don't want to talk about how we aggravated Japan to bomb Pearl Harbor. That was a sneak attack. Surprise, surprise. Look how horrible they are, right? We don't want to talk about too much about the internment and what it was. We want to talk about the model minority, how they rose. We lifted ourselves by our bootstraps. We rose to be successful. So why can't you? Right? It's called triangulation. And then we don't even talk about how the war ended, right? The dropping of two atomic bombs, which was totally unnecessary. Totally unnecessary, because if you know history, we were in negotiations for surrender.
Yes,
Professor?
Oh, definitely. That, again, is we struggle with that. It's not that it's, there is an answer to it, to that particular position of hegemony. But coming from four different cultures, four different nationalities in my case, I learned how bad the United States is by learning Mexican history. That's to the extreme. But then you come to this country and there's no history. So what do you do internally? And I think our social responsibility as people who are invested in the betterment of humanities, our responsibility is to present a balanced view of history. And remember, when you write history, you write it from a particular perspective. The history you hear, you're not going to hear in another place. I'm not saying that these histories are fully incompatible. What I'm saying is that we need to create in our people, in our students, in our ethnic groups, a sense that transcends those borders and bring us to a better notion of what it means to be human being. And that is the mission of the United States. For me, the economic, political power that it has, it's nothing, because I'm more preoccupied with the future of this country. And our future is embedded in the moral responsibility we have to the world. This is a unique country, putting together with people from different places, nationalities, different ways of life. We either teach the world how to do things differently, with higher consciousness, or we will be destroyed.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Kevin Huang, and I'm studying political science here. Earlier on, Irene, you were talking about how you said Roosevelt knew about the attacks on Pearl Harbor. Does that circumstance parallel Bush's knowledge of, you know, the 9/11 attacks and just lack of action, or was that kind of like, how can you go into a little bit more depth about that?
I don't know. Really, where the controversy or the facts around 9/11, if Bush knew or not, but that he used it as an excuse, right, to invade Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, and he used that weapons of mass destruction. He created a moral panic around the fears that were right. You know, the fears around 9/11, etc. So I can't say for sure. I know that there's documentation on the sneak attack, so to speak, sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, because there's been years and there's been opportunities to really research it. But we do use these sorts of traumatic experiences as excuses to move to places we want to go, right? And I want to echo what Dr. Solorzano said. Now, while we talk about this, while we talk about these inequalities, these inequities, these traumatic experiences, is it so that we can hate America? No, it's so that we can actually know that where we need to move to get to the America that we want, right? People say, well, how did we get here? Why are we so racist? Why are we so this and that? And I said, because we've always been that way. We've been sexist. We've been racist. We've been that way from the beginning. I mean, if you want to talk about the beginning of this country with our forefathers, they were all slave owners, every one of them. They got their riches, their wealth, from the slave trade. It's a documented fact.
Did you have something to say, Ambassador?
Let me just add to that. There's no... The situation in World War II and its situation in 9/11 aren't even in the same conversation. They're totally different. 9/11 was about the movement, the Al-Qaeda movement that started back in 1989 in Afghanistan. But it presented itself even further with a man named Osama bin Laden, who created a fatwa, which is a declaration of war against the United States. And he did that in 1990 when we moved in with our troops to help to, when Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait. But he planned a lot of attacks, and one of those was 9/11. He planned embassy bombings and attack on ships and so forth. And he did that in Sudan between 1991 and 1996. So it goes back into a history of an Islamic situation with Wahhabists, way different than the situation that has anything to do with World War II. So comparing the two is not the same.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off. We have one last question.
Hi, my name is George, and I'm a mechanical engineering major. But there was talk about cultural genocide and also how the history is written so that the winner is glorified. Do you think that eventually, since how we're kind of losing the historical like cultures and stuff, would it eventually die off and that we wouldn't know what kind of culture we came from and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, that goes back to the signs we see all over campus, never forget. Is there a fear of forgetting, and are we forgetting, and what can we do to remedy that? John Price.
Well, I think never forget goes beyond the Holocaust that we've talked about. And I would have to say it encompasses the entire world because we're all survivors. Had Hitler succeeded in conquering the world, none of us would be here. So we're survivors, and we have to keep remembering that, and we can talk about our own ethnic backgrounds and our religious backgrounds, but I think we have to think about it globally. And again, the United States seems to forget unless we talk about it once a year, twice a year, and the media doesn't play it up. I'm glad the university does and that Randy does. He's very good about that. But a lot of the Jewish organizations don't. And I can only speak about that side of it. So if we don't remember it through the media and through the Jewish organizations and so on, then it's going to be forgotten by the next generation. And it's the same with other cultures. I can't speak to the other cultures, but I think it's a global issue. And we need to be inclusive, and we're all under the same tent. That's all I can say. And I'm sorry if I feel that way so strongly about the United States, because there are inequities here, many of them, but it's still the greatest country on earth. There is no other place that has the freedoms that we have here. And I travel a million miles every year or so. I go to Africa many times. I'll be gone again next week. And I'll tell you, when I talk to people and I write articles about it, they all want to come to America. They all want to come to America. And even with some of the problems we have, it's a great country. That's all I can say. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Irene, briefly.
I think that we mythicize our cultures, as Dr. Solorzano said, and I think that's dangerous because cultures are never static. They move, they grow, they change. But there's this sense of authentic identity that only the individual can decide what is theirs. And that needs to be validated. And so what is important to you to be who you are, right? And part of that in the United States, because the dominant discourse wants to, the people who are dominant get to create these labels, get to create this mythicized history, it's up to you to do your research, to look at your own past. I mean, my history is different from my friend's history, my friends whose parents were interned. My parents experienced the firebombing, right? It's a different history. But does that make me any less a Japanese-American than my friend? What does that mean for us? I know a little bit of Japanese. She doesn't, because she's third generation, right? It gets lost, as you said, Ambassador Price, right? Quickly by third generation. Does that make me more of a Japanese-American than my friend, right? What makes us authentic? What makes us us? Well, it's how we pull into, right, our knowledge of our history, our knowledge of our past, and who we want to be, despite what dominant society says we are.
And Professor, very quickly.
Yeah, very quick, because it's part of my propaganda. I'm just writing a book that is called Remembering the Future. And what I try to capture here is precisely the notion that the only thing we have is a future. The questions that are raised here are mainly questions to the educational institutions in the United States. what are we doing? Have we lost our mission? What type of individuals are we creating? Can we really forget history? If you forget history, you are nobody. You will get lost. You will not have a vision, and people without vision will perish. So we need to look exactly how we are conforming our own universities. But that is, again, everybody's responsibility. In my case, I look at my past. I look at my history. I cannot live without history because we are going back to the origin. We always go back to origin. All these ecologist movements in the United States are the movements of the native people, of the Indian people of the continent 2,000 years ago. Protect your mother nature. Be kind to your people, because even when you die, the earth is going to be generous with you. He's going to be treating you with care. That's projection. Remember the future. And I will want you to stay with that sentences, because that is our future.
Very thought-provoking discussion today. Thank you very much to our experts, Irene Ota, John Price, and Armando Solosano. Thank you very much.